so many times, you know, your mom or just neighbors telling you, hey, pick your head up, hold your head up high, don't walk with your head down, you know, just little things like that. And as you grow up, you realize how important those little nuggets were in terms of your representation and your presentation in the world.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum the colorblind ideology built?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hello, everyone. Hello, hello. Welcome, welcome. I am Tricia Rose, and I'm here with my dear friend and colleague, Brother Cornel West, on the tightrope. These are painful and intense times that we are launching this podcast. I thought COVID-19 was going to be the worst of this spring and summer, but now we have just unprecedented levels of protests based on obviously many, many things, but most recently the brutal killing of George Floyd. I believe they're laying his body to rest today. The cities are up in arms, things that I thought I'd never hear, we're hearing. You know, George Bush is saying he's against systemic racism. I never thought I'd hear that. We're here to do lots of things with this conversation today. One is to seek some sources of inspiration, insight, build community. And of course, who's a better person to do that with than my dear friend, Cornel West. Welcome, Cornel. How are you?
It's always a blessing to be in dialogue with my dear sister, Tricia, Professor Rose. What a force for good and vision you are.
Thank you, my dear. Thank you. This is a mutual feeling. So, you know, we've talked a little bit about what we're going to do today. You know, I just wanted to set us up for a moment and see what you're thinking about this topic, which is inspiration and insight is obviously critical for what we need now. But we're going to talk about Black creativity some more, but in the role of athletes, right? Athletes in the Black community have been so important for many things. I mean, there's a whole aesthetic dimension. The complete reconfiguration of the rules of basketball, just as a quick example. But also, they've been very important in social justice movements. Athletes and artists have been so important in coming out of the community and giving people a sense of hope and possibility, but they understand fully the struggles that Black communities face. But who are some of your favorite athletes and, you know, in the ways in which you think they've been politically important?
Yes. You know, I always try to situate our precious Black athletes, male and female, within the context of the Black freedom struggle. And I think it's very important to always understand the Black freedom struggle as an anti-terrorist movement. We're fighting terrorism. The Black freedom struggle is a anti-trauma movement. We're fighting trauma. And it's also a anti-hatred movement. So that the Black freedom struggle as a love train, to put it in the language of the OJs, tries to convince us to love truth, love goodness, love beauty, love excellence, and myself as a Christian to love God. So that when we think of the athletes, they love beauty, they love truth, they love excellence. And many of them were religious. They love God. They love goodness. So you think, for example, of I think probably the greatest one for me is Muhammad Ali. Now, as Christian, I love my Muslim brother. But Muhammad Ali at the highest level loved justice, truth, beauty, excellence in such a way that he was willing to sacrifice his whole career in order to bear witness for truth and for justice. And he, in that sense, sets a standard. Now, he also happens to be one of the, if not the greatest athlete of the 20th century in many ways, too. And there's a whole lot of candidates, because, I mean, when it comes to athletics, good God Almighty, we got such a rich tradition of Black athletic excellence that we couldn't even begin to have a show and end it by September. I mean, is that that long a line that we have? But the important thing is we should never reduce athletes to entertainers. We should never reduce them just to technicians of the body, as opposed to how they stylize their body on whatever the terrain is. It could be a field, it could be a court, but they're stylizing their body in order to play with others in order to win, or they're in the boxing ring all alone, but still stylizing their bodies tied to a truth tied to a beauty, tied to an excellence. So I would start with Muhammad Ali in some ways as my candidate, but I always situate my brother Muhammad Ali from Louisville, Kentucky, within that long, rich tradition of Black freedom fighters.
Yes, indeed. And when you look at the history and the footage of what the narratives that were surrounding Muhammad Ali, we hear many of the same kinds of responses to his politics. Athletes today attempting to participate and make a claim about social justice in the present tense. You know, I'm thinking here just quickly of LeBron James or Colin Kaepernick and others who are literally reviled for just simply asking for the same kinds of social justice and proper treatment that many other people ask for. And it seems implicit that the expectation is that they shouldn't have anything to say, right? That they should have role to play.
That's exactly right. Because they want to separate the mainstream, the establishment. And the establishment is not just vanilla. It comes in a lot of different colors now. We talk about the establishment. We're talking about the status quo. But the status quo does not want to connect athletic excellence to moral courage, to spiritual engagement, to political activity. So they say, okay, you're excellent, stay in that corner. Do what you do in that corner, but don't let it spill over. And we have a long and very rich history of having Black athletes who refuse to be compartmentalized in that way. And that to me is highly encouraging. And it's not a matter of dictating to these athletes whether they should think the way you think. You just want them to be free.
Right.
Be free, just like our musicians. Be free. See, Muhammad Ali was a free Black man, the way Richard Pryor was a free Black man. And you know we're not going to agree with everything Muhammad Ali and Richard Pryor talk about.
Maybe not.
It's that freedom itself that becomes important, because it means then you're going to say what you mean and mean what you say. Quit wearing the mask. Right. Quit posing and posturing like you're somebody that you're not. Just be yourself.
Right. And, you know, I think of the Williams sisters. They had to basically manage just kind of racism that you wouldn't expect to see in this era. But I also think about the women's basketball team that first kneeled in support of Colin Kaepernick. It was, if I'm not mistaken, it was a women's basketball team that first supported that effort en masse. And of course, women's contributions are unfortunately too often diminished in these kinds of conversations. But I just wanted to bring them up because sometimes when you are valued less, even inside of the athletic arena that you're in, it's a little bit easier to be in protest because you're already on the margin.
That's very true. That's very, very true. And that's really something that has become more visible in the last, 50 years. I mean, we had Althea Gibson and other great athletes in the past before that. But in the last 50 years, I think that the sisters of all colors, but disproportionately chocolate, have become more prominent in the public imagination, being highly visible. And that's a beautiful thing in terms of them being able to bear witness, but also recognize, I mean, like just like the musicians that are athletes, they got to practice. You know, it takes a whole lot of time to reach the highest levels of athletic excellence. You got to love what you're doing. You got to sacrifice and you got to practice and then recognize, you know, who the great ones were before you came along.
Right. You know, I'm so glad you said that about practice, because one of the things that I think is so disturbing about the underappreciation and the discrediting often of the discipline it takes to be as amazing as many athletes are. And we have a special guest coming shortly. We're going to talk with him.
He's a special champion. That's right.
We're not going to tell anybody who he is yet in case they don't know. But this whole thing, somehow the idea is somehow you just run up and down the court and you just invent something. It's natural talent, right? It doesn't take discipline. It doesn't take creativity. It doesn't take an alternative way of thinking, and it doesn't take the level of woodshedding. I mean, it takes hours and hours and hours, obviously for athletes, also for musicians and for intellectuals, right? But the presentation looks so effortless that people think it's just some natural talent. And so part of that is one of the ways that these creative individuals and community members are not just discredited, but devalued, even as they're celebrated, right?
That's exactly right. And I also think that the white supremacist attacks on precious Black people has taken the form usually of not just keeping us scared and intimidated, but it attacks our intelligence, attacks our moral character, and it tries to convince us that somehow we can only do what is quote unquote natural to us.
Right.
And in the white supremacist world, what's natural to Black people is singing, dancing, and playing sports. So that it's the sense of, lo and behold, the athletes are brilliant and sharp in the mastery of their craft as anyone in any profession. But it's in athletic context that Black people, for the first time in the history of America, could be in a structure of fairness, given the fact that every other site in the society was a structure of unfairness. So that when Jack Johnson stepped into that ring, he started knocking white brothers out because they had fair rules. As soon as he walked out of the ring, they had unfair rules. Or when the basketball players finally got a chance, the Blacks played with the whites, and if the referee's going to be fair, for the most part, the referees were fair, lo and behold, Black excellence could flower and flourish because finally we had a structure of fairness.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes It was only in the athletic arena that you had some structure of fairness in the game. Now, you didn't have structure of fairness in terms of who owned the team. You didn't have structure of fairness in terms of who would have assets, who would be the owners, who would be the executives, who would be the business folk, who would be the background bureaucrats. No, that was going to be still deeply racist and white supremacist. But when you stepped in that ring with your gloves on, the white brothers and the Black brothers are going to slug it out. And who wins, wins. That's why when Jack Johnson won, it would be riots all around the nation because it gives Black people a sense that given fair opportunity, we can win. The same is true on the basketball court. Same is true on the football court. Same is true on the baseball field and on in tennis. And so that has a very special kind of gravity, I think, in a white supremacist civilization. And that's why athletes and that's why musicians have played such a crucial role in our struggle.
Right. So I don't know if many people know this about either you or me, but you played sports yourself growing up, right? Weren't you a track runner?
Oh, I was supposed to be one of the greatest athletes of my generation. I've been living a colossal failure for the last 40 years, but that's all I did my early years was I was going to athlete. Oh, that's the truth. It was all about Willie Mays. It was all about baseball, definitely.
What did you run? Did you run the 400 meter or what was your area?
Well, my brother Clifton West was the greatest track athlete, one of the greatest track athletes of his generation with Eddie Hart and the others. And I would get up and run in the morning with him. And because he was a senior and I was a sophomore, then when it came to me running against a sophomore, I'm setting records. That was a 2 mile. We were distance runners.
Wow.
We ran cross country. We ran 2 mile. We ran the mile and even longer than that. So we'd run 10 miles every morning before 6:30 in the dark. And so I'm still actually building on that 50 years later in terms of staying in shape.
Yeah. Well, there's plenty of running in the dark going on these days, for sure.
Ooh, isn't that the truth?
Yes, indeed. But, you know, I played basketball my whole childhood and played pretty seriously long before there was a WNBA. And I remember thinking, you know, how is it that there's no place for women to play basketball? I mean, I was obsessed with it, but there was really nothing I could do with it.
So,
although I was not good enough to make it in the WNBA today, it was amazing to be so invested in something and there was literally no place for people to recognize you in doing it.
But it's very interesting, though, that you were an athlete in that way. Because, see, when we were then running, we had Tommy Smith, we had John Carlos, we had Panther Party, we had Martin King, of course, who was supporting the boycott in Mexico with Brother Harry Edwards and others. So there was always that sense of connecting the athletic excellence to the moral courage and political activism in that way. But when you were coming along, who would have been your heroes that brought together both athletic excellence and political engagement?
Wow, that's a good question. Certainly it was Muhammad Ali, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Tommy Smith and John Carlos were very big. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Well, Kareem, too. Yeah, absolutely.
We had in my high school, it was Scholar Athletes Dinner because I won Scholar Athlete for the school. And we had Nancy Lieberman as our guest speaker. She was the only semi-professional female basketball player in existence. I mean, this was the late 1970s. In the sport of basketball in particular, it was impossible to find anyone.
Wow.
But of course, Althea Gibson. I mean, all around Paul Robeson.
Oh, yes.
You know,
indeed.
pretty much. And then eventually, you know, Cheryl Miller was just very important later on, but I had given up basketball and had luckily not tried to do anything particular with that. That would have been a colossal failure.
Did you play basketball at Yale?
You know, I would have, but I had too much work study. I had to work too many hours of work study to pay for that tuition, bro. So I couldn't do it all. But I also played volleyball. So I did play club volleyball at Yale because you could do it without the level of intensity that basketball required.
Right.
The other thing was,
right.
You know, I went to a private high school. So my height, I was too short really to be a center. But in that context, I could play center. But by the time I got to Yale, the centers were like, you know, 8 inches taller than me. So
No, I hear you.
I have to give it up. So now in terms of long distance running, it's my last question, then we're going to bring on our fantastic guest. But I'm wondering, were there many long distance black runners when you were running?
My brother was going to be the first black man to break the 4-minute mile, and he ended up running like a 4:01. He still holds the record at UC Berkeley for the freshman at this very moment. But no, there was very, very few. We had Kip Keno from Africa, from Kenya, who was an inspiration in terms of black distance runners. Mm-hmm. But no, that was the age of Steve Prefontaine and Jim Ryan. There wasn't a whole lot of black folk running long, long distance. But when it came to the sprints, it was a chocolate affair.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Well, we could talk all day, as you know, but we should definitely be ready to welcome in our fantastic guest today. He is not only a 12-time NBA All-Star, but he's a 2-time NBA champion, and he's also a dear friend. We have Isaiah Thomas with us today, basketball legend. Welcome to the tightrope, Isaiah.
Hey, thank you for welcoming me. And I would just like to add, I grew up on the west side of Chicago, and the neighborhoods that I came from, I was considered a long distance runner.
And why was that, Isaiah? Tell us a little more.
Because I got chased home every day. Every day I got chased home, and I became a long distance runner, a sprinter, a boxer, you name it. I had to do it in my neighborhood every day to get to and from school.
You were an amateur champion, huh?
Yes. I even became a high jumper because I had to jump over that fence to make sure that I could get home.
Oh, my God, my God. Oh, Brother Thomas, remember, you have enriched our lives in so many ways in the form of your artistic excellence in basketball, but then also going on becoming a coach and manager and owner and so forth and so on. But we were talking before about what it means to actually come out of the blocks and have a jump start in spiritual life coming from the rich west side of Chicago. I think of Curtis Mayfield. I think of Ramsey Lewis. I think of Maurice White. All of y'all from the west side. What is it about the west side of Chicago, brother?
I didn't realize when I was growing up how blessed I was. You know, every day I woke up, there's the poverty line, and then there's that line below poverty. And I grew up where they didn't count you. And somehow you had to find a way to find a meal every day. And if you couldn't find a meal, then there was always people to give you some good advice and to always give you some good music. So when you talk about Earth, Wind, and Fire, and you talk about Curtis Mayfield, and you talk about just the richness that's come off of the west side of Chicago from a knowledge standpoint, music, it is truly a rich place. And I think it goes probably back to all of our roots. Most of us, you know, our families came from Mississippi and from Vicksburg, and that migration to the north brought all the spirituality with it, but also brought a knowledge base with it that was spoken to us in a way that made us not only want to survive, but also understood that we had to strive and be responsible for taking on politics, taking on sports, but yet maintaining your dignity. The people that grew up in our neighborhood, even though we were poor, every day you woke up and your shirt was dirty, but you had to button it up. The old man sitting on the corner, you know, he always had a sweater on and a tie, and they always looked nice. They always, you know, made sure that you walk with your head held high. And I can remember so many times, you know, your mom or just neighbors telling you, hey, pick your head up, hold your head up high. Don't walk with your head down. You know, just little things like that And as you grow up, you realize how important those little nuggets were in terms of your representation and your presentation in the world.
No, indeed. I was just in the West Side with my dear brother, Reverend Hatch, Marshall Hatch, Mount Pilgrim Church. And he got this magnificent program dealing with the young brothers who are coming out of the gangs and getting transformed and becoming a freedom fighter for Jesus, a freedom fighter for the least of these, for the people. But I've always thought there was just some kind of special stuff down the West Side of Chicago, produced folk like you all. I said. But then you ended up in Detroit, though, man. Detroit also, it's got that rich history.
Detroit's our sister city. You know, up and down 94, that corridor, highway stretch, that's where I can still remember my mom taking me to the amphitheater to see the Staple Singers and Aretha coming into town. And you had, you know, Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5 coming out of Gary. You had that whole Motown.
That's true. Chicago corridor
from a music standpoint was not only teaching you good music, but the music was also uplifting and also teaching you how to communicate with people. The things that you weren't learning in school, you actually learned in music. And also on the West Side of Chicago, the teachings of Noble Drew Ali was on the West Side of Chicago. A lot of the gangs, actually, their inception and their birth was around some of those teachings, not necessarily what we call gangs today in terms of their, you associate them a lot now with murders and the selling of drugs. But most of the gangs, when you read their charters and you read what they were established for and what they were brought into existence for, it was to protect against police brutality, which we're still dealing with today. And it was also to educate and teach you about civics and constitutional rights. That's where the gangs were formed. And they were community-based organizations trying to move away from racism, but trying to also build up our communities. And as they got more powerful and their messages became more stronger, then the government moved into the West Side and wiped out everybody. And you can read all about it in COINTELPRO.
Yeah. You know, Isaiah, tell Cornell and our audience, you gave me a riveting summary of you were personally witnessed, what, 3 or 4 major riots and protests before you were 10 years old on the West Side. Can you just share that with everyone here?
So my first 10 years of life on this earth, 1963, Kennedy was assassinated. I was born in 61. 1965, Malcolm X was assassinated. And 1966 was the first Chicago riot. And all these riots that I'm talking about, these were in my neighborhood. I remember the National Guard pulled up off the Eisenhower Expressway on Congress and Holman. And I lived 3340 West Congress. And the barrel of the tank was actually pointed at my house. And if any of you go back and just YouTube the 66 riots, that was in my neighborhood. And they would talk about Western and Pulaski on fire, burning down. That was in 66. Then Martin Luther King is assassinated in 68. We have another riot. We have 2 riots on the West Side of Chicago in 68 because the Democratic National Convention came to Chicago. We had that riot. And then Martin Luther King was assassinated in 68. That was also a riot in our neighborhood. So while all these riots were happening and the burning down of buildings, no one came in to clean up. No one came in to rebuild our community. So you had to walk to school every single day. Then 69, Fred Hampton is assassinated. And Fred Hampton was assassinated, you know, by the Chicago police. My mom worked with Fred Hampton, and her and Congressman Rush were part of the free breakfast program that I ate at a lot, and also went to school there to learn what we call STEM now, where they was teaching math, they were teaching science and math, and also civics and the Constitution, and teaching you how to deal with the police. So Fred Hampton gets assassinated in 69. I was one of those kids that had to walk by his house and view the murder scene and view the bullets that had come through the walls and watch his case being tried. So that was my first 10 years of life on this earth. And that was my existence in terms of what I was going through, but also going to school every day.
Good God Almighty. You know, I was listening to the brother Rodney Floyd, the younger son of our precious brother George Floyd, who underwent this public lynching just a few weeks ago, and he said, we didn't have much, but we had a lot of love in the Third Ward of Houston.
Mm-hmm.
I think of that in terms of Glen Elder, where I grew up, chocolate side of town, for my first 8 years in SACTO, that the whole lot of us may not have had a whole lot of things, but we did have a lot of love. And you have this overflowing smile, brother, that's connected to your heart and soul. So it's not just as a great athlete. There's a whole lot of great athletes who still got a lot of chilliness in them. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Coldness and detachment. And that's true for anybody. But you're the opposite of that, though, man. Say something about the love formation on the west side of Chicago. I know you are Isaiah Lord Thomas III. Is that right?
Yes.
You the third, man, from Mary and I tell you. But just say something, though. What went into you that allowed you to have this quest for truth and excellence that has been manifest so often in your own life, man?
I was brought up and it was instilled in me these five values of love, truth, freedom, peace, and justice. Those were the five pillars that I grew up around. And when you talk about the love on the West Side, what I grew up in is a spirituality, and I really didn't realize it, but it was a spirituality of just people looking out for each other. And particularly in the sports world. The sports world, we were always taught that in sport, the oppressed in all society, in terms of people of color, they don't necessarily get the voice or get the microphone. So the athlete, he or she who happened to make it or be a champion, their responsibility was to speak for the voiceless. And not only for the voiceless, but lend their voice to the academy, which you two are distinguished a part of. And so you can work in concert with each other. So I would never forget walking out of the door in 1974, when the Boston public schools were being integrated in terms of busing. I was walking out of the door headed to school and my mom grabbed me by the collar and said, sit down, you need to watch this. And I was like, Mom, I'll be late for school. She's like, you may miss school today because you need to watch this. And there was a Caucasian woman that came on television and she was speaking about how she would never let her kids go to school, and she used the N-word. And my mom said to me, and I'll never forget these words, she goes, this is why we root for Bill Russell in Boston.
That's powerful. That's powerful, brother.
And this is what they had to go through. And so when you talked about Muhammad Ali earlier, Muhammad Ali spent a lot of time in Chicago. And what Muhammad Ali stood for us, it wasn't that he was a great boxer, which we all knew. But the fact that his presence, his being, his love, his generosity, his giving, his no one's too big, no one's too small. And the fact that people would take the time to look at you and remove the shame and embarrassment that you carried as a poor young man growing up on the West Side. It was always important for us to make eye contact with each other and to acknowledge one another. Very rarely when I was growing up did you walk by anyone and you didn't acknowledge them with a brother or a sister, or just to acknowledge them as people, just acknowledge them as human. Because in this society, the acknowledgement that you were looking for, or the shame and embarrassment that you wanted to get off of you from being poor, it was important that we gave each other that kind of love. And then Earth, Wind, and Fire, the knowledge that they was dropping spiritually, when you go back and you look at their album covers, what they were speaking to us with their album covers, and, you know, Keep Your Head to the Sky and Happy Feelings, you know, the music was uplifting and it was teaching you about yourself. It was teaching you to look within. We were taught to look within. And when you look within, then you can rise above. So learning all of that and then connecting it to the science of your body definitely help you as an athlete. Because with the athletes, what we do is we connect mind and body, while the description of us is always described from the neck down. But we as athletes, what we have the unique relationship in terms of with time, in our body, in terms of putting those two things together. So what they would describe as instinct, my father would always tell me that, no, you just think faster than the average person.
Ooh. Mm. Wow.
That's beautiful. That's powerful, brother.
I think there's something so important in that trio, their time and mind and body. Can you talk a little bit about your process of basically elevating in such level of skill and vision as an athlete? Were there certain things that you approached it with? Did you carry certain of the things that you're talking about into your practice? I guess, what's your secret, Isaiah? How'd you do it?
basically it was geometry and physics. When you look at the court, you're playing with squares, circles, and triangles, and understanding the different degrees of the angles, and then understanding what we call chemistry in terms of getting people to work together. Mm-hmm. But it's really E equals MC squared in terms of using force. You always hear players talk about rhythm. How do we get in rhythm? How do we get in sync? We're out of rhythm. So there's a way of communicating, nonverbal communication that happens out on the floor when you are in sync with each other. So the way I played the game and the way I approach the game, time really slows down. When I say it slows down, most people think when they count numbers, they count 1, 2, 3, 4. But when you watch an NBA game, you'll see that the athlete counts 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, 0.6, 0.7, 0.8, 0.9, 1. Now, you watch a game and you'll see 0.6 seconds left on the clock, and a lot of things can happen in 0.6 seconds. So all relationship with time is totally different than the average human being that's living and hasn't played at this higher level. Our relationship with our body is totally different. Knowing how to make it move a certain way. Well, I'll put it to you this way. Now that I've given you this example, and we'll talk about Dr. J and Michael Jordan, how great of flyers they were in the air. Imagine them coming down the lane and all of a sudden in a split second, they got to jump up and then spin around in the air. And not only spin around in the air, then find the basket and dunk it at the same time. So that mind-body connection is on a totally different level than the average person.
That's true. That's profound, though, brother.
Yeah. And by the way, you got to do that in a half a second.
You got to do that in a half a second. You see, I saw Oscar Robinson. I saw Guy Rogers and them used to do that. But now, then LeBron, too, just taking it to a whole new level. Let me raise this one question, and that is, given all this richness and all of this courage to be the best, how do we bequeath it to the younger generation with our precious young sisters and brothers in athletic engagement as they connect with the brothers and sisters of all colors on the street, bearing witness to truth and justice? How do we keep the tradition alive? That seems to me to be a question that is so fundamental. Right now.
Yes, indeed.
So as I critique my childhood and my growth, and I look back and I realize how enriched I was by having access to the educators, to the academy, to the music, to the musicians, to the teachers, to the spirituality of the world. All of that was in my neighborhood and part of my growth, which is in everyone's neighborhood. What has happened, in my opinion, as we've moved away from our base in terms of our roots and our foundation, is that we've gotten singled out into one lane. Like, we may just go strictly into the academy. We may just go strictly into sports. We may just go strictly into music. We do not have the well-nurtured or well-rounded embrace of all the lanes. So me having the opportunity to be on a show right now with Professor West and Professor Rose, or Dr. Rose, Dr. West, just having access to this type of knowledge, having access to this conversation. It wasn't rare. It used to be that this is what was in the neighborhood every day. So we have to get back to is our community. We can't have these invisible walls. We can't have these invisible lanes. We got to cross over and touch each other, speak to each other, and tell our oral history as well as our printed history.
That really speaks to what the elevation of athletics into entertainment has done, because it creates kind of celebrification, which makes it much harder for people to retain those very connections that you're so right to focus on. We have some bunch of people here in the audience who want to ask some questions for our distinguished guest, and hopefully we can get to a few of them here. Isaiah, you're up for a couple of questions?
Yes, I am.
All right. Do you feel that the strength of Black athletes and leaders when speaking on behalf of the people, is it more grounded in a spiritual tradition or a more secular set of experiences for people who've been voiceless in the past?
I would say it's always multitudes. It's never just one space. So in the past, I would say that the connectivity of everyone being together, a Malcolm X meeting a Muhammad Ali, a Dr. King and a Bill Russell socializing with a Luau Sindor, then now Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I would encourage everyone to go back and look at our brother from Harlem, Luau Sindor, now Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who has now got his voice back because for so long, the sports world had silenced him and had given the mic to others to speak. And to Kareem's credit and to what he was able to do was maintain his dignity. And now I think the brother has written 12 books or 13 books, four documentaries, and he's still going. And now he's back on the scene with his voice. But you have to remember Muhammad Ali and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in their youth, they were not very well liked. Kareem Luau Sindor boycotted the 68 Olympics. Muhammad Ali won his court case, but the boxing committee didn't allow him to box. Most people think that he lost his court case. No, he won his court case.
Yeah. Before I go to some other guest questions, that's something I really want to ask you and make sure that our audience hears your answer to, which is many people know about your athletic achievements and even your business leadership and companies that you are, you know, either CEO of or have founded. But you went on late in life to earn your master's degree in African American Studies and Education at Berkeley. And, you know, that's a serious level of investment. Why, after all your success and all you know and have lived and learned, did you feel it was so important to return to school to do that?
I was taught, and I am a forever learner, and I have a curious mind. It was instilled in me at a very young age when they talk about knowledge is power. My father had all kinds of books, and he made sure that whatever I was learning in school, I also had to learn our history because he made sure to tell me that you are learning American history, European history. Now, let me tell you about our history, where we come from, who we are. And Christopher Columbus did not discover America. There were people already here. So just emphasizing those things made me always a seeker, and knowing what my mom and dad and that generation before me and before all of us had truly sacrificed. They would not pay the rent so you can go to school. They would not eat food so we could go to school. And that's how important education was to that generation. My mother only had a third grade education. So it was important for our family, the kids that she was raising, to go to school. And that's where I'm at. And I'm still trying to learn. I'm trying to learn from both of you. And you can never know enough.
Right.
And I think the beautiful thing, too, is the distinction James Baldwin used to draw in talking about the great Lorraine Hansberry, the difference between keeping the faith and making it. You see, when making it just about big money, status, celebrity, stature is one thing, but keeping the faith with your celebrity status is a different thing. So when you want to put a smile on your precious mama's face, and that becomes a fundamental point of reference, then that frees you up in terms of whatever establishment you got to deal with, whatever folk coming at you from TV or whatever it is. And that's a spiritual and moral thing. It strikes me though, brother.
Well, thank you for that. And I can't take credit for it. I can only be happy that I was given that and that I had parents and mentors and friends and everyone else who would take the time to teach me and tell me the rights from the wrongs.
Yeah. A number of people are very moved by these stories and the historical framework that you're providing. I'm so glad that you really unpacked it, because when we think about the 60s, we think about just very visible leaders. We don't think about this deep infrastructure of love, support, and re-education, right? And
exactly.
Right,
exactly.
On the ground, that really is the source of the survival, right? It's the source of the, really beyond making it, to go back to Cornell's point, but to help people thrive and resist deterioration that is planned, really, right, that is expected. But one person has a question about what structures can we use to create more access to these kinds of stories, since they're not part of formal education. How can we create more widely available venues for this story and these insights? Do you have any sense of things that are going on or ways that we can focus in this way? Because the richness of what you're saying, Isaiah, is so important and so under-talked about.
I would suggest that the first thing we have to all come to the conclusion about, you know, America is that most of us have been miseducated about America. And how do we dig deeper in terms of finding out this America? They say that the victor gets to tell the story. Well, there's some untold stories. And how do you find the best thing that I think we have available to us right now on the internet, in Google? Start Googling, start researching. Professor Rose, you said I went to Berkeley, and the thing that I learned at Berkeley, which is one of the best public research universities in the country, was I learned how to research. And learning how to sift through and learning how to track. I would just say, start watching videos and start learning. That's the best advice I can give you. I mean, I can tell them to read your books. I can tell them to read Dr. West's books. There's another gentleman, Dr. Anderson, Claude Anderson. I would read his book. I would also read some literature talking about Moorish Americans and also talking about the Moors, talking about what America was like before 1492. Or before 1776, getting a deep, rich understanding before we were classified as Negro, before we were classified as colored, you know, Black, African American. And what do those things mean when you talk about systemic racism? And when you compare South Africa in terms of apartheid, and then you talk about America, you'll see some similarities in terms of the color-coded privileges that we have in terms of rights, civil rights, citizenship. All these things need to be discussed and unearthed and truly talked about. So when you talk about systemic racism and you talk about the system, all, again, you're talking about civics, you're talking about law, you're talking about the Constitution, and understanding before you check that box, understand what that box means when you check it. Now, there's no pure anything. We all live on a hyphen. We're all mixed with something. Being classified as a color has really put us in a place here in America that we need to read more about and talk about, because these are the things that systemically, when we talk about systemic racism, being classified as a color gives the system the power to discriminate and also puts you in a position where you are less than, or the white box starts on third base and you in the dugout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. No, I hear you. We're almost out of time, which is hard to believe. I just looked up at the clock and couldn't believe it. You have to come back, Isaiah, if you're interested in joining us.
Yeah.
Love to keep talking with you and hearing more. I feel like we just scratched the surface here to get a sense of the richness of your thinking. And, you know, we just want to welcome you back to dialogue anytime.
You are Brother Dr. Thomas. I'm going to tell you that right now.
Don't mean honorary, no.
thank you for having me. And if I can leave everybody with one thing who's listening, we won the right to vote in 65, but the Senate actually gets to vote every 25 years if we can continue to vote. So we should think about that. And we want the right to vote forever. And we don't want anybody deciding 25 years from now if we can get a contract extension to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Well put. Especially, yeah, given the way these contracts are turning out. This is true. I appreciate that. Isaiah, this was wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us and really gotten us thinking deeply over here. So thank you for this fantastic time with you. We'll see you again soon.
Indeed. Okay. Salute you, my brother. Love you, man. Salute you. May God bless
your
family.
Both of you. Thank you.
Wow, Cornell, that was a heavy session right there.
It was extraordinary. Extraordinary. Yeah. Good God almighty. I think we helped some folk listening today. And when we get this one as pilot, we put it in, it's going to really empower some people. You know, that's the bottom line. That's what we're trying to do. It's going. This was so rich. So what do you think, Sister Tricia?
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I just, when you realize what the depths of both absence and presence that he comes out of, right? I mean,
yes, exactly.
You know, right? It's the intensity of both of those things, the hunger, the tanks, the violence, the police, right? The lack of educational meaningfulness. And then his mother, and, you know, the city and the free breakfast programs and his father's emphasis on education. It's just, it's just riveting, really.
It really, absolutely. I don't think a lot of people understood the depth and scope of this brother, you know. God almighty.
Right. And
really that's something.
This is the problem with this entertainment complex that we're in, because it takes this kind of legacy and knowledge and subordinates it, gives it no home. It's really a homeless kind of knowledge and history. And instead, we got to ask 8,000 micro questions just about what happened in somebody's championship. But even that, wait, one more thing, Cornell, before we leave this topic, his analysis of what's going on the court is so profound. We don't even hear that in the entertainment complex.
Oh, look. When he got into the time and temporality and 0.123, the rhythms and everything, and this is part of the culture of the team.
Exactly.
In the NBA.
Right.
It's like, oh my God.
Right.
Ooh-wee.
And the way in which, you know, he's using time and his mind and his body in complicated dynamics all at once together. Not only the math of it, right, and the literal math that has to be done on the court, but then to do it in sync and in rhythm and to do it so quickly.
Quickly. I mean, that's why I call it artistry of the highest order, you know?
Right, yeah.
Artistry of the highest order.
Yeah. Ooh, that was heavy now.
Thank you for listening to the Tightrope Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast and share it with everyone you know. Please email all questions, suggestions, and compliments to 411@speakerbox.com. That's the numbers 411@speakerbox.com. The Tightrope Podcast is produced by Speakerbox Media in collaboration with the Podcast Laundry Production Company and is executive produced by Dr. Cornell West, Professor Tricia Rose, and Jeremy Berry.